brings me right back to high school. I so very much love ZZ Top. Oh, my God. We are going to have a fantastic show. Brian is at Kansas Sherm, and I believe it's in Kansas City this year. I can't remember, but anyhow, he's at Kansas Sherm. Pay attention to the hashtag. They've got some good stuff going on. In fact, he's speaking right now, so he will not be on the show. And Nisha is with her husband's parents, so her in-laws. And so she's off the show. And so it's Joe and myself. Joe, do me a favor, or do the audience a favor. Introduce yourself really quickly.
My name is Joe Gerstant, and this is my third or fourth time on Drive Through HR, but it's good to be back. And a big part of what I do is speak and write, mostly about issues related to diversity and inclusion in the workplace.
Genius. And so let's just kind of get right into it. Let's start with conflict. When you talk about conflict with your audience and with your clients, obviously, and things like that, where do you start with conflict, and where do you want to push them towards?
Well, I think the starting point is just starting to have a conversation about conflict and understanding its value in the workplace. And conflict is something that I've spent more and more time thinking about and talking about over the past year, because it became pretty obvious to me that regardless of who the people involved are, if we are trying to benefit from diversity and inclusion, one of the ways that's going to show up is that when we gather together around conference room tables and we talk about stuff that's important to us, we're going to have difference. We're going to have disagreement. We're going to have different perspectives, different priorities, different values. And so that really needs to show up for that conversation to be valuable. And what I see is that there's some organizations that do conflict really poorly. It gets personal, and they do it in a disrespectful and a dysfunctional way. But what happens way more often, at least in my experience, is that teams and groups and organizations in general avoid conflict. And I think when there's no conflict, it's easy to think that, you know, everything's fine and hunky-dory, and isn't this nice that we all agree with each other, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. And so I think the starting point is just talking a little bit about conflict and that it is an important and valuable thing. And if you don't have some of that, and it needs to be done well, but if you don't have some of that showing up, that conflict and disagreement, then you've got a different kind of problem, right? You've got some groupthink going on. You've got some dishonesty for one reason or another. If we want those conversations, collaborations to be effective and meaningful, there's got to be some difference inside that space.
So conflict can be an indicator of health, on either poor health or good health, et cetera. So how do we keep track? I mean, how do we, as managers, as leaders, as HR professionals, et cetera, like, do we have a meter? Do we have a conflictometer? Like, how do we keep track to know, are we tracking poorly? Are we tracking in a good way, et cetera?
Well, I think to some degree you can kind of gauge, and I think it is an indicator. I think it's a really accurate indicator, and I think it tells you a lot about organizational culture. But I think on an individual level, you can measure it just based on, you know, by thinking about the teams that you're a part of, the social processes, conversations that you're a part of, even the one-on-one relationships that you're a part of. Have we demonstrated the ability to both disagree with each other candidly, openly, and honestly, and agree with each other on things, or do we get stuck doing one or the other? I think most folks kind of know where their team or their department is when this conversation comes up. So I think looking for the absence of conflict and looking for conflict done poorly, those are some of the indicators that you look for first.
It's funny, I just got off a call with a client. We were talking about this very thing and really it being rooted in the value system of the firm. And he said, you know what, I like direct communication, but really in our firm, I like direct communication that's nice. Like I want it to be, there's a treatment of that. Like if someone just comes off, hauls off and gives me direct communication, but it takes out the knees of the person that's receiving it,
yeah.
That doesn't work in my organization. So he had linked, you know, direct, you know, the ability to be succinct and be direct, but also to care enough, have empathy about the, you know, receiver of that data, et cetera. So let me ask you about values. What's the relationship between, in your mind, between either inclusion, diversity, conflict, et cetera, and values, corporate values?
Yeah, I think there's a very close link, and if inclusion is something that you are really serious about in your organization, one of the ways it should show up is that you should be all willing and able to disagree with each other in healthy and respectful ways. You know, I see a lot of organizations that say big, beautiful things about diversity and inclusion. Maybe they've even gotten better about hiring people that look differently. The problem comes is that they're not really allowed to think differently, right? They're still expected to be on the same page, to all pretend like they agree with each other. If you really, really value inclusion, you shouldn't want that. You should want there to be, you know, a fair amount of disagreements and dissension to show up in your conversations and your decision-making processes. So if you take a look at those, you know, for lack of a better term, if you take a look at the social processes inside your organizations, the meetings, the conversations, the decision-making processes, I think that is kind of looking into, that's kind of a window into what the organizational culture is really about. Are people allowed to disagree there? Are they only allowed to disagree with certain people? Is it safe here for me to disagree with my supervisor? How about my supervisor's supervisor? Can I disagree with that person? You know, that stuff, which is almost never written down anywhere, you know, how we make decisions and deal with disagreements, that stuff I think tells you a great deal about what the organization truly does.
How often, in your mind, do we need to revisit our corporate values? One of the questions really trying to get at is, how fluid are they? If we all go off-site and we sit around and we really kind of cook the values in such a way that they really are the values that we live, meaning they're not just words, they really are who we are, how frequently do we need to go back to that process?
I don't know that I have a good answer for that question. I do think it's something that needs to be revisited. I think something that's got to happen on a little bit more of a regular basis is, you know, the effort of holding ourselves accountable. You know, having values or aspirations or ideals is one thing, but really working to find the gaps and hold yourself accountable, that's harder work. And I think that's oftentimes your organization's struggle. Are we on a pretty regular basis saying, if these are our values, is there any proof of it? Are we behaving accordingly? Are we looking at our values and saying, is this informing how we reward and promote people and who we hire? Or do we make a lot of exceptions from those things? I think that's the stuff that needs to be really revisited on a regular basis. When we make decisions, do our values show up in that conversation, or is it driven by something else? I think the work of holding yourself accountable to those values is kind of an ongoing process, I would say.
Yeah, it's the implicit versus explicit. The values have to work right without you. And if they work without you with new employees, frontline employees, in your hiring process, then your values are still spot on. Right. And if not, as you said, making exceptions with it, which is brilliant. What's the role of the disgruntled, rogue, maverick, renegade, contrarian in an organization? What's the role for those folks?
Well, I think that person's perspective is really, really valuable to the organization. I think most organizations have a hard time dealing with that perspective because it's a constant disruption, the constant source of friction, and the entire practice of management is kind of based on removing friction and inefficiencies and things like that. So there's some real tension there, but I think, you know, that's where new insights come from. That's where new perspectives come from. That's where that creative tension that drives really good decision-making and problem-solving and creativity comes from. So I think that it's pretty important, but I think in most organizations that person isn't treated very well. You know, they're not treated very well. They're not seen as a team player. They're oftentimes not promoted. So I think, you know, this is another place where implicit and explicit shows up. If organizations really value questions and different points of view and different perspectives, they've got to do things to really protect the person or the group of people that brings that in. And on an organizational level, sometimes you see that kind of play out in large ways. There's some organizations that have, you know, a skunk works. They've got a part of the organization that's really about exploration and seeing things differently and trying different things, but they're removed basically from the larger organization, so they don't have to constantly face that tension and that pushback. But most organizations aren't big enough to do that, and so I think if we we really are serious about innovation, and we really are serious about being adaptive and learning and some of the things that we're talking about in business today, we've got to, I think, as organizations and especially as managers, we've got to do things to protect that person that is, you know, the oddball, the heretic, the outlier, the person that, that sees things differently and wants to try a different approach. Because I think in most organizations, that stuff kind of gets pounded out of them or they go away.
It's funny you mentioned friction, and I always think of friction. I think of it like in the muscle, you know, when people actually, you know, build their bodies and they do a lot of kind of a muscle gain. Every time that they're doing something in the gym, they're making little tears in their muscle, and they're they're creating these little tears that then heal and then become muscle, right? So it's like that's the friction. That's how you get strong, right? Like, how we haven't brought that into the business world and say, there's a reason companies aren't innovative. And the reason that they're not innovative is that they're ethnocentric or they're homogenous or they're whatever. There's a lot of those things. It's because they've stomped out. They're so effective in stomping out all the friction that they have no innovation left. Like, go ahead.
To some extent, that's the ideology of modern management, right? Management is about, you know, and I'm not talking about the people doing management, but the practice of management is about removing inefficiency and removing variance and all of that stuff. And so you know, we've got a pretty big lever inside of our organizations that's constantly at work trying to remove that stuff from the process. So I think organizations, despite all this talk about innovation, they're really, really a long way. Most organizations are really, really a long way from being good at doing that. They're actually, contrary to what they say, they're actually removing that capacity from their organization on a daily basis because they don't want the friction. They don't want the pain.
What is the role of failure in an organization? The context of the question comes from NASA and NASA's ability to consume failure in the 60s is what got us to the moon, is that they celebrated failure. Like when somebody, because they had to fail fast. Their whole hardwiring getting to the moon in 10 years, they had to fail really fast, celebrate it, everybody eat cake, let's get some champagne, celebrate those failures and get on to the next, like, what did we learn? Most companies aren't set up that way. They kind of hide failure, they obfuscate, et cetera. Like, what's your take on how we're purposeful or not around failure?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's connected to the larger issue that we're having. I think failure is really important, especially if you do want to learn, if you do want to innovate. I think failure is just, you know, it's a different kind of data. It's a different form of feedback. But it's not treated that way inside most organizations. And this goes back to, you know, implicit and explicit values, because there are more organizations talking about the importance of learning and the importance of failure, but everyone in the organization still knows that, you know, you don't want to be attached to a failure. We don't want to even admit that anything failure. And I think part of it is that we've gotten so used to trying to drive these big changes through our organizations. You know, when something needs to be changed or fixed, you know, we put a committee together and the committee writes a charter and they meet for 18 months and we put together these big change initiatives that go through the whole organization, and they're so big that, you know, we just can't survive failure. So we're certainly not going to admit it. I think by going back and focusing on a little bit more grassroots change, individual-driven change, we can make those changes smaller so that failure is survivable. You know, if we're just tweaking things and making small changes in what's right around us, then if it doesn't work out, it's not a big deal. You know, there wasn't a huge investment of political capital or financial capital. So I think some of it is just about the size and the scale of some of the changes that we're driven to. Instead of changing an entire organization all the time, you know, let's try something out in our department. Let's prototype it and try it and see what happens. And if it doesn't work out, it's no big deal. We change it back and we try something else. I think, you know, so I think, you know, the level of change that we're driving helps us move a little bit in that direction. But I think, if, you know, in organizations where failure is not allowed, I don't think you're ever going to I don't think those organizations are ever going to learn much, and I don't think they're going to be able to be very, very innovative.
What's interesting is we've got a lot of things wrong here, because in hiring, we want candidates to be perfect. I mean, whether or not explicit or implicit, every question that we ask is all oriented around them being perfect. And we want the most perfect of the perfect candidates, and those are the people we filter in. And in truth, what we want is the people that are that you can see all their flaws. That, hey, listen, I took nine months off and traveled to Europe and smoked a lot of weed. So, like, what did you learn from that? Like, you know, like, it's the failure and that friction stuff that we need to pull out, tease out, in the hiring process, but also like something like performance management. Think about how wrong we have that, where if you have failure, it affects your company, it affects your compensation, it affects everything. It's like, you know, wait a minute, why do we do that? We're actually incentivizing people to not try stuff and to be perfect.
Right.
So
I think politics, you see this, you know, magnified 1,000 times in politics. I mean, it's gotten to the point where if you're running, you know, if you're running for national office, if you're running for president, you can either be honest or you can be laughed out of the race. I mean, you cannot admit to ever having done any, I mean, even when you were in high school, you know, you couldn't have ever made a mistake. It's so ridiculous. And we, you know, we contribute to this. We contribute to this by the way that we vote and the way that we interact with candidates. And, but I think that same thing on a smaller scale shows up in the dynamics of a job interview, you know, performance evaluation, all of those things. Absolutely.
It gets me into trouble every time because Bill Clinton was my perfect president because he fit the two criteria that I care about, extremely smart and very charismatic. Outside of that, I don't even care. Like, it doesn't matter, religious affiliation, anything else. I don't even care what party he was with. I need intelligence, and I need somebody that won't bore me to tears when I watch them on TV, et cetera. So let me ask you about there's a lot of people talking about diversity. You know, you go to every conference, there's always somebody out there rolling some new bit out about diversity. And really, I don't want you to talk badly about anybody, but what drives you into a wall in terms of kind of the national dialogue around diversity?
You know, I don't know. There's a lot of things, I guess, that drive me into a wall. I think one of the things that that frustrates me is that I go to a lot of conferences and I don't see anything about diversity inclusion on the agenda. I think, you know, some folks are of the state of mind that, you know, we did that for a while and it's kind of been fixed and we don't have to talk about that anymore. There's this, you know, kind of let's move on to something else as if this is an issue that, you know, comes to an end or something like that. I think, you know, another part of the conversation that frustrates me is that I think a lot of the conversation and even a lot of diversity inclusion work is still built on this really antiquated, faulty, binary idea that there are good people in the world and they're non-judgmental and non-biased, and then there are bad people and they're judgmental and biased. And so this work is about finding bad people and fixing them. And we've changed the packaging and the language a little bit from like the 70s and the 80s, but the underlying approach, the underlying paradigm is still that way, and I think that's problematic. I think that the conversation on a national level isn't built on an accurate, evidence-based understanding of human nature, of how human beings interact and deal with each other. And I think that, you know, going back to the conference circuit, the folks that are talking about diversity inclusion, when I do see those sessions at conferences, and I go to a lot of conferences like you do, a lot of times I don't see anybody rolling out anything new. It seems like it's still stuff that was kind of stuck in the last century, in the last few decades. I don't see a lot of innovation. I don't see a lot of creativity. I don't see a lot of disruption. The conferences that I go to that are specifically focused on diversity and inclusion are some of the most reserved, kind of formal, traditional conferences that I attend. And from my perspective, they should be some of the most experimental and noisy and chaotic conferences, but they're not. A lot of the social innovation is coming from other places. It seems to me like it should come from diversity inclusion practitioners, and it should come from HR practitioners who are experts in people and social, but it's coming from design folks, and it's coming from other folks, and that's kind of frustrating for me. It still seems like we're having a difficulty getting HR people and diversity inclusion practitioners to even really aggressively use social technology. So, you know, I'm infinitely frustrated by nature, so there's no shortage of answers to that question.
Nice.
I think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you know, I get into hot water with this one because I believe if you did unaided recall survey with HR professionals and you said the word diversity, most of them would either say affirmative action or African American. And in their minds, it's tied to that. And it's like, well, I think that was a great jumping off point. I'm with you. There's so many other things that we could be talking about and really innovating, being the bleeding edge and leading the rest of the organization into much better, deeper conversations. And again, that's kind of the safe move. Let me ask you about examples of inclusion done right. Like anything that you can think of, because I think sometimes they while they might even misunderstand diversity, they even more misunderstand inclusion. So if you can, tell the audience a little bit about where people get that right.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we kind of, you know, just like you mentioned, a couple of things that come to mind for most folks when you throw the word diversity out, I think there's this idea about inclusion that it's, you know, it's kind of an attitude or a state of mind. It's about kind of wanting to be nice to other people. And so most business leaders, most organizations, most managers, most HR folks will be very quick to say, I'm inclusive, or we are as an organization inclusive. But if you say to them, what are the things that you do to include difference in groups or processes intentionally and deliberately, almost none of them will have an answer to that, right? They're not actually doing anything. They just think that because they're a good person, they believe themselves to not be, you know, hateful or bigoted or whatever, that they are inclusive. But I see inclusive being an activist thing. It's the actions that you take to include difference in a group or a process. And I think some of the best examples, interestingly enough, come from some organizations that don't even talk that much directly about diversity and inclusion. I think organizations that really, from their beginning, have been about innovation, I think they do some pretty interesting things. They don't necessarily label them as being about diversity and inclusion, but they do things to harness difference, to bring people with different perspectives together and to put them into a space and to wrestle new ideas and breakthroughs out of that. I think that organizations like Zappos, of course, we have to mention Zappos. I would like that redacted from this conversation. Organizations like NPR and Pixar have done interesting things to, you know, with the architecture of their physical space so that people from different departments working on different projects are constantly bumping into each other, right? They can't go through life siloed and segregated from each other. So things like that certainly aren't a part of, like, traditional historical organizational diversity inclusion initiatives are pretty interesting to me. I think there's a whole huge opportunity connected to social network analysis or organizational network analysis, actually mapping the networks of relationships inside the organization, because I've found some interesting correlations there. When an organization has disparity in some outcome, if they've got, for example, if they've got engagement numbers or retention numbers that vary drastically by things like age or gender or race or even department, a lot of times there's a correlating disparity in the social networks that they're attached to. The people that have less engagement or shorter retention are oftentimes connected to much smaller, much more narrow social networks. That's kind of a new emerging practice, but I think it's a pretty powerful intervention, a pretty powerful technology for diversity inclusion folks. There's organizations, and this is also something that shows up, I think, mostly in tech companies, but efforts inside events, things like hackathons, where you bring people from different departments and different lines of work together to try to fix and solve things. And they're not necessarily always focused on technology or products or services. Sometimes they're focused on fixing things inside the organization. I work with an organization that aggregated all of their exit interview data from a year and then brought together a group of 50 or 60 folks from across the organization. They spent a day trying to figure out how to fix that stuff. That's a pretty cool practice, and I would say that is, you know, connected to what we're trying to accomplish with diversity and inclusion folks. You know, there's still a lot of diversity training that goes on in targeted recruiting, and I think there's need for that, but I think I'm really interested in some of the newer stuff that's showing up, and I think finding ways to diffuse that is is a big part of what I try to do.
Nice. I think we're all kind of conflicted beings. We're all managing different anxieties and biases and conflicts and whatnot.
Absolutely.
One of the conflicts I've been wrestling with lately is that, you know, I do everything I do for my family. Love my wife, love my kids, you know, but I travel. You know, I travel a lot for work, for clients and conferences and all the other shit, which takes me away from the very people that I'd like to be spending the most time with. And so there's an inherent kind of conflict that, I, you know, daddy's got to go, you know, shake the money tree. And in doing so, daddy's got to be away from the very people that he'd like to spend more time around and this, that, and the other. So there's this conflict. What conflicts are you wrestling with?
Well, that's one right there that I'm dealing with. I think, you know, the better my business does, the more that I travel. But, you know, a big part of why I do this is for my family. And so I struggle with that conflict right there and how much is too much and, you know, where's the right place. I think another thing that I struggle with a little bit as a straight, white, middle-aged dude in Omaha, Nebraska, doing diversity and inclusion work, one of the things that I struggle with is that I really try to champion a broader approach and a broader definition of diversity and inclusion. I think at the same time, and I believe that. I do that. I've spent time really thinking through that, and I think I have good logic and a sound argument. At the same time, I think I have to make sure that you know, I'm not heard as being the straight white dude from Omaha, Nebraska that's come to tell you that, you know, you really don't need to think that much about gender and race and orientation that much. You know, we need to think about these other things, diversity of thought and that stuff. I think I need to find, you know, I need to really be aware of where that line is. I have some responsibility, I think, to the larger body of work that I'm doing, because I do think that we have a lot of challenges connected to race in this country. We have a lot of challenges connected to gender and orientation. I don't think that we're doing a bang up job on any of that stuff. So I'm not trying to take those things off the table, but I am trying to introduce some other things to the argument. I feel, you know, sometimes that's a source of conflict. And I don't want to make it. I think this is an issue that comes with a certain amount of reflection and discomfort. I don't want to be the guy that comes and makes it too easy for people in the name of shaking the money tree.
Well, in some ways, it could be an if-then. You know, this could be an if-then statement. If you feel like you've got race covered in your organization, you feel like you're good there, great, go forward. If you feel like you've got gender covered in your organization, great, go forward. Like, you could put these, I mean, we both know that there are a lot of interconnected parts and whatnot, but you could make it an if-then statement and say, well, let's not go to these other things until we at least got, you know, we need to get our house in order. Do we have our house in order? Great, all right, well, you know what, solve for that.
Yeah.
And if so, let's look at some of these other, because you're right, you could easily be the guy that, you know, the white guy that basically said, hey, it's okay not to, hey, the white guy said we didn't have to think about race anymore.
Yeah.
Shoo!
Yeah. Right.
Celebrate.
Yeah, I'm trying not to be that white guy, so.
That's fair. Let me do, we got about a minute left. What's, how can people reach out to you? What's the best email address, Twitter ID, blog, what do you got?
Yeah, probably my website, joegerstandt.com, joegerstandt.com. And on there is all the other ways to connect with me. I've got a booking agent that's, her address is on there, and an email and Twitter and the Facebook and all of that stuff. So I have a pretty unique name. You can just Google it and you'll find your way to me. So I'm fairly
fantastic.
Easy to find online.
Well, you, again, fast 30 minutes. Thanks, Joe, for coming on. Everyone, thanks for listening to Drive
Thru
and Chew. And have a wonderful weekend. Let's get some ZZ
thanks,
Top going. All right, brother.
Real my friend Ryan in that Texas town. About to check outside the games. And you know what I'm talking about. Just let me know if you wanna go to that home out on the range. They got a lot of nice girls.